old school.
Difference day.
It gets really tough when they're three and four syllables.
Yeah.
Do you think this way? Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 122 of Registry Matters. Larry, do you have your mask yet?
I do not have anything other than a few dust masks.
I was thinking about this and I was like, okay, so, you know, they're suggesting that you wear one at all times now. Okay, great, whatever. I don't have anything. I don't have a bandana. I don't have any masks to cut the grass. I don't have anything that I could put on my face other than like tie a t-shirt around my head.
That's probably about all I have. The dust mask are probably no more effective than that. But I think it's interesting. I was struggling with the advice the whole time because they were saying don't wear a face mask unless you're caring for someone who has the virus or unless you have the virus to protect others. And the caring for a person really troubled me because if the person is able to excrete droplets that you would pick up, but the mask would protect you. If you're caring for a person, obviously you wouldn't be trying to protect them from getting it if they already have it. And I couldn't understand how it would protect you from their droplets, but it wouldn't protect you from droplets that would be excreted by people who maybe had not been diagnosed yet. It seems like to me, if it'll protect from droplets, it would protect from droplets no matter who the person was. I can't think of a nice way to say that, that was excreting the droplets.
The infected plague-carrying person.
Yeah, so I was troubled. And then those that have been listening for a long, long time know that I've questioned how the things that we've been able to do a long time ago, we somehow can't do now. And you know, the example was ending homelessness in 1970. By the 1970, we didn't have homelessness. Getting to the moon by 1969, and then there was an effort underway in the 90s to get back to the moon, and they discovered it would take longer to get back to the moon if we were to try to go than it took in the original effort to get to the moon. And I'm thinking, well, where did the knowledge go if we could figure out how to get there? We figured out in 1918, the U.S. was on the cutting edge of several cities and locations around the country required masks, and the evidence from the articles I've been reading in the last day or two suggests that it was very effective. And then the U.S., that knowledge wouldn't have gone down to the evaporation. So we knew 100 years ago that people should be wearing masks, and there was a benefit from wearing masks. And then the whole continent of Asia, every time they have an infection, you see practically everyone wearing a mask, at least the people who make it on TV, they're in public. But yet we dropped the idea of covering our faces, and it seems like that was basic knowledge we learned 100 years ago.
I wonder, I've been thinking a lot about this since you brought this up to me a couple of days ago, that I wonder if a lot of this doesn't come from a completely disjointed message from the top down of how serious this is. When this all started, we knew about it in China and it being called the Chinese virus. And so it's like, it's not going to hit America because we're exceptional. What, like, no worries. We knew in December that it was happening, and then we saw things escalate. And both us and South Korea detected it in country on the same day. South Korea ramped up their entire infrastructure to deal with it, and social distancing and masks and all that stuff. What did we do?
Well, I don't. I'm going to probably let my liberal progressive listeners, if we have any, down. But I'm not going to be quite that bizarre. You know, the United States is a vast, vast nation compared to South Korea in terms of territory. And we have vastly different governmental structures. There's the federal government of this country was designed to be a very weak government. And the listeners out there are going to say, well, gee, he's nuts because we have a very strong central government. But that's not the design. The design is for the states and local governments to do the most of the governing, except for those powers are specifically reserved for the federal government. So I'm going to let my progressives down to think that what I'm saying, that I don't think the state and local people did nearly enough. I don't think that there was enough planning between hospital administrators. I don't think there was enough local preparedness done. I don't think that there was giving thought to an epidemic. I think that most of the state and locals washed their hands of it. It's kind of like the federal disaster relief. Before we had the FEMA, that we had very little federal. We had a previous predecessor called the Office of Emergency Preparedness, which was mostly dealing with civil defense with the threat of a nuclear attack. But responding to disasters has morphed into a federal responsibility. And again, not so sure that that's what the founders intended. And I think that I hear so much criticism of the president of the administration, and I wish that if the locals and the state governors are going to be so critical of the president, I wish they would be a little bit more self-examination of themselves in terms of what they could have done better and what they will be definitely doing better going forward. And so I've been a little bit disturbed by the constant barrage of criticism. I mean, it's difficult to look ahead and say we're going to have a pandemic in 2020. And we're going to buy millions and millions of ventilators, and we're going to buy millions and hundreds of. It would take hundreds and hundreds of millions of masks to be able to cover every American. And we want to stockpile these, and we want to put them in. Can you imagine the political sell that would be? Okay, now, Mr. President, you want to spend $17 billion for emergency preparedness for a pandemic, and now, what evidence do you have there's going to be a pandemic? Well, we know there will be sometime. Well, I mean. Politically, that's just not an easy sell. It really isn't.
I won't disagree with you there, especially, you know, capitalistic nation. We want to spend money on something that maybe is going to happen. But we did see this coming for people to potentially go out and buy their toilet paper a month in advance, not just wait till all of a sudden the day flipped and Trump went from being very dismissive of it. And you can find clips of him for a month long. Oh, man, there's only 8 cases in the country. Oh, this is going to blow us right by. And then all of a sudden getting on television, his hands clasped on the desk saying, oh my God, we now have something that's a serious threat to our country. But it was a one day flip. I think that was in the middle of March when he gave that national address.
Well, I'm thinking that weekend of March 12th, 13th in that range is when I had my own epiphany. I had largely been, not because Trump said it was, I had largely thought that since I had lived through so many health scares in my lifetime, I was under the same notion that it was an overreaction, and I was very dismissive myself until a particular weekend when I read all the information I could get. And again, it's constantly changing, for example, the mask recommendations. But I read all the information I could get, and I said, wow, this is very serious, because it has the potential to be a pandemic, and it has the potential to hurt a lot of people. And it has, when there's no vaccine, there's no treatment. I quickly, Brenda can attest to how I went from being dismissive to saying, gee, I was wrong. this is serious stuff. And we don't know who was advising the president. We don't know. We know that the president tends to be a dismissive person. Everything is in his vocabulary is the greatest. He tends to overstate. I'm like, the greatest economy ever. That's true. Not the greatest economy ever. It's a good economy. He inherited a good economy, and it was a good economy at the time he was sworn in. But he tends. I mean, he's just not a person who his persona doesn't allow him to be this is doom and gloom. I mean, that's just not who he is. And I'm not magically becoming a Trump fan, but I would like to be fair to the president.
Tell us that you actually have like a Trump plushie at home and you just cuddle at it when you go to sleep, right?
Well, as I've been homebound more, I've seen more and more stuff that just, if I were in Trump's position, I would be reacting the way he's reacting to some of it. I mean, I saw Acosta, I didn't put it in, but I saw Acosta with just constantly from CNN, for those who don't know who he is, because our audience probably watches Fox more than CNN, but Acosta just, he won't even let the president finish a question that he asked him. You know, he starts, and finally Trump has to say, well, excuse me, let me finish. You know, if you don't like the answer, you need to at least let the person finish. So he's just so rude. And he was asking him about Azar, who's the health and human services secretary, who said the biggest thing that scares him is that there might be a pandemic. Well, if you're the secretary of health and human services, that would be something that you would spend a lot of time thinking about. You know, are we prepared for this? But again, putting forth a plan to get prepared for something that may or may not ever happen, it's tough to sell in a political environment. Now, it may be easier to sell going forward now that we've gone through this shutdown. It might be easier to sell the notion of stockpiling stuff. But prior to this, looking ahead, prior to this, it would be very tough to go in and get those type of appropriations.
Tell me this, knowing that we had 3 million unemployment claims and then 6 million, do you think that kind of sort of in a handful of months, we quote unquote give the all clear and we click a switch and 20 million people go back to work in 2 weeks or something like that?
Since we're in such uncharted territory, I don't know how they're going to. It's easier to shut things down than it is to restart things. How you reopen a significantly shut down economy. Now, the economy is not completely shut down. I mean, people, that's a misnomer. There's a tremendous amount of segments of the economy still working. Factories are still running, churning out product. People are still buying groceries. The trucks are still on the road moving stuff. Emergency services, hospitals and police and fire. There's a tremendous amount of the economy up and running. But the parts that are down, like putting an airline industry, when you've parked, I think some airlines have grounded over half of their fleet.
I'm sure.
And sent their workers home. And bringing these people back to work with the psychological damage that's been done, the scare of being in public again. People are not going to magically. We're telling people now that they need to wear a mask when they're in public. Can we produce enough face masks to satiate the desire without a vaccine, assuming that you can't get a shot in the arm that makes you immune from this? Can we produce enough protective equipment where the population will be ready to return to work when the all clear is sounded?
I wonder if it's not just, so it's probably at least 6 months away from a vaccine, that somewhere in that range when we get a vaccine and like we can inoculate the planet, like everything then goes back to normal.
I'm hearing a whole lot longer than 6 months. I mean, I'm hearing
heard on the short side it's 6 months, yeah. But it's somewhere between, you know, 12 to 18 months. But we're months into it now, and the virus's structure is very similar to SARS. So they already have, like, working models. This is way outside of my zone of expertise. I just hear, I'm basically regurgitating what someone else has said. But we're not starting from scratch in working how it works. Anyhow,
well,
we should move
on. It's going to be a learning curve for us to figure out how you shut down a significant part of a vibrant economy, and then you're doing it in a democratic society. It's a lot easier in a society where people have less democratic when you can't vote to change things. It's a lot easier to issue orders, but we're in a country where if we tighten the noose too much, politically it's not going to. There's going to be a repudiation. We're going to have a lot of discussion about these decisions where they were necessary after this does pass. And
of course.
So in terms of Trump, first of all, there's the separation of state and federal responsibility. And I'm not sure that the federal government can shut down all the states and issue an order. Right. I'm not sure that authority is there. But these governors who are in these states that are holding out, they're holding out because they feel that they don't have the people's support. I mean, that's what's causing them to hold out. If you don't have the people's support, it's difficult. This is a voluntary system of self-containment. There's no way to police. You have to want to contain, and you have to want to stay home. You have to want to contribute. This is a small contribution based on what we know now, that if you can possibly stay out of public and out of contact, you help yourself and your fellow humans to not be infected. And you have to want to make that contribution because there's no police. Cops can't guard everybody's door and make sure they don't go anywhere.
That's something I wanted to throw at you is just you being the explainer of things and how language works, me being, let's just say, above average intelligence. The order came out to lock down Georgia at 6 o'clock last night. And I read through the order and my main concern for me is, can I go outside my door and go for a walk in the morning at 5 a.m.? I normally don't run into anybody, but I sure as hell don't want to run into a cop and go, put the cuffs on because you're outside of your house. And the first line says, you're only going to work, to or from work, if you're in one of those critical fields. You're only going to the grocery store, and you're only going to the doctor or getting meds. And I'm like, well, that's pretty simple. And then it goes on, it says, you can go to a state park. Well, the first order says don't go outside unless you're going to work, you know, groceries, whatever. So how am I supposed to go to a state park? And then also it says you can exercise outside as long as you're not really near anybody. So that means we could drive any flipping where we want to and just say, I'm going to the state park. It's confusing in the way that it's worded. I understand the intent, but just those, that first order says only go to these four places. Oh, by the way, you can go to state parks.
Well, I think that, again, it's something the citizen has to want to do. There's enough leeway in every order that I've even glanced at that they're really not enforceable. If you have a group of people, yes, because in our state, more than five can't get together simultaneously. Right. But if you're just simply out navigating someplace, there's really very little they can do. If you're navigating by bicycle or on foot or in a vehicle, there's really very little they can do. It has to be, I think we had this conversation, it has to be a contribution you're willing to do yourself. Like in World War II, when people were willing to be rationed. They tolerated rationing because they knew that the sacrifice would lead to more supplies to the troops and more supplies to our allies. They tolerated keeping their lights out in fear of bombing raids because if any group of people decided that our personal needs are greater than the community that we're living in, the fear was that the bombers would fly overhead and start targeting towns. So there were people who were the whole country didn't go to lights out, but based on intelligence and intercepts, they would figure out where enemies were trying to strike, and they would call for lights out back in World War II. And people did that because they wanted to contribute to their own safety and everybody else. That's what happens to this. You have to want to make a contribution that's non-monetary. Basically non-monetary. You have to want to make that contribution for the better of society. If we can keep people further distance apart until this crisis abates, it's a small contribution to make. There's really no enforcement. You're not going to find people going to jail for this hardly anywhere. It's not going to happen.
I certainly agree with you, which is an amazingly good segue, Larry, if you're ready to go over what I would have as breaking news. I'm not sure if it's like breaking news, but the executive director of the Georgia group, which is called Restore Georgia, he's got reports that people are being arrested for not going to register. You know, it's their birthday month or whatever. And so he's getting reports that people are getting registered. Excuse me. He's getting reports that they're being arrested for not registering during the shutdown.
I saw that report, and I did speak with him before the recording earlier today, and I asked that he try to do some more research to figure out what's going on, because being that we do have listeners that value some of what we say, I want to be as concise and accurate as we can be. The fact that a person got arrested for failing to register does not mean that the facts that underlies that arrest occurred during the blackout period, or when you're told to social distance and not do but these essential things are on the order. So, for example, if a person has a warrant outstanding where they haven't been in compliance for 3 months and they happen to get pulled over and the warrant was in the system, the cop is going to take them into custody unless there's an order that the jail is closed, but they're going to take them into custody. So I asked if he could try to figure out. The first clue would be the dates of the booking to find out if they've been booked during this blackout period. And then if they were booked, if we could get the actual affidavit for the arrest or the criminal complaint, if one's been filed, to see what the underlying facts are being, as they're being alleged by the state. And if it is alleged that they have failed to come in during this period, I think they've got a very, very good case that the case will totally collapse. If the violation was for something that occurred prior to this period, their case is significantly weaker. I mean, still, I wish we wouldn't put people in jail for a regulatory affair, but their case is a lot weaker if the facts arose prior to this crisis.
And on that list, I don't think it said anything about going to the registration office as part of one of the quote-unquote exceptions to this shutdown order.
Well, it did not seem to say that in any state that I've read. They have not said that would constitute an exception. So I would read that literally. I would assume I mean, Scalia has taught me this. I would assume that the executive knows what they want to exempt. And if they wanted to exempt people and say you must continue to register, just like they wanted to exempt for you to be able to go to pharmacies and to go to medical care, right, they would in have parts. Put that in there. They would have put that in there. So I would assume, since it's not in there, that that's not an exempt behavior that you're allowed to engage in during the curfew between the stay-at-home ban.
Excellent point. I mean, they thought about putting state parks in there. So you would think that if they wanted to, they would have put the registration office in there.
Yes. So I would, and like I say, I think that if any of these cases where he's uncovered that people have been arrested, if they did arise during this period, if the facts underlying that, I think those cases are going to largely vanish. Now, that doesn't make it right that they got arrested to begin with. But I think the case is not going to result in a conviction, because first thing I'm going to do is to call up the prosecutor and say, you really want to go forward with this? Because you know what my defense is going to be. I'm going to say they were under a quarantine order. And I'm going to say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury,
of course,
this person's under a quarantine order. And the Gwinnett County prosecutor is bringing a charge here when they were forbid to go. And not only that, I would not think that we would want our deputies to be in this type of danger. So, I mean, I'm going to seek jury nullification. That's what I'm going to do. And I think I'll get it.
Interesting. Well, let's move on to Larry. How many, can you count as high as how many articles we have?
No, this is beyond, I think, any other episode.
We have a crap ton of articles related to Corona, and I'm going to leave them in there for if you want to peruse them, but we're only going to cover a handful of the highlights of them. But this first one, before we go down that whole path, is, Larry, I'd never heard of this one. This is called From the Crime Report, and it says, don't have your felon card in Alabama. That's a crime. This, I've never heard of somebody having a felon card. If you get convicted of 3 felonies in any state, then when you're in Alabama, you have to get this felon card. And if a cop asks you to present your felon card, then you go to prison or jail for not having your prison card or your felon card. What in the crap is this?
It's not that odd. There were more states that had felon registration laws before sex offender registration. And I think Nevada, so there's another state or two out there that still require, maybe even California. But yeah, this is one of those things where it's on the books but seldom enforced. This would be what they would enforce if they wanted to have something on you. They didn't have anything else.
It seems sort of like just, you know, fishing for something, though. I don't want to say entrapment, because I know you'll thump me for saying entrapment. But I mean, even like the one of the featured people in the article, he's a black guy living in an affluent white neighborhood, dating a white girl. So then the police pull him over and like, we knew we'd get you for something. Give me your felon card. He's like, what?
Well, that's what I'm saying. They have to want to get you. Now, Alabama, what's the population? 5 million, I'm guessing. I know it's not sure as large as Georgia's, but it's millions. But more than 300 people have been charged since 2014. Now, I don't know where they ran the data through, but say they ran it through 2019. We can see it's not actually a deluge, and we can assume that there's a whole lot of felons in Alabama. and there's probably a whole lot of people that are not complying with this. I'm not condoning of the law, but I don't think that it's widely. From 2014 to 2018, there were 235 arrests in Alabama on charges of not having a felon ID, and 53 separate charges of failure to register with the local sheriff. So it's not like that it's something that's happening day and night all around the clock.
Your estimation of Alabama's population is 4.888. So you're right on top of that one. And that's roughly the average IQ of Alabama, too.
4.88.
Can we move over to this article?
Alabama is a state where there's massive amounts of problems. That deep south, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, they tend to have an undereducated population, kind of like us in my state. And then they have health crisis galore in the south. For some reason, obesity is just so rampant. And I think it has a lot to do with air conditioning. But when everybody can sit on their sofa and drink Kool-Aid or whatever they drink and not get any physical exercise. Sweet tea, yeah, I forgot that. But the obesity rates in Alabama, Mississippi, those southern states are just off the charts.
And Alabama is also where they do the license marking, right? Well, that was where it was challenged.
Yes, that's one of the states where they do that. Yes.
Let's move over to law.com. Governor gives California Chief Justice unprecedented authority to address pandemic. Isn't this some of our people are kind of worried about this turning into something of a power grab by the nations and the states to control all the peoples and institute martial law and all that silliness? This seems something along those lines.
Well, it was something we talked about on the Narsilon Action Sunday call that I pointed this article out to Janice Bellucci that Governor Newsom issued an unprecedented executive order freeing Chief Justice, and I can't pronounce that, of statutory restrictions on her authority to issue statewide court orders addressing COVID-19. So the 3-page order, I wonder if we should put that in the show notes, but apparently there's extraordinary powers vested in the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and some people find that very scary.
Do you see anything? I've realized like the scary part, but like one of them, it suspends that limit by telephone depositions. This allows them to do telephone depositions in the interest of keeping people safe.
So what? Which on the 8565? Which one of these are you? I first thought it was B, but which paragraph are you reading in the order?
It would actually be the second one. It says the 3-page order, which cites the governor wide ranging power under state emergency, also suspends laws that limit by telephone depositions and the service of process by electronic means. Two changes sought by the plaintiffs' bar and defense counsel.
So I was actually on the order itself, which if you click on that link there. So I'll go back to the article.
So does that mean that they can do depositions by phone where in the past that was somehow limited?
I think that's what it means.
Doesn't that make them more efficient at being able to do it because having a telephone call would be quicker as far as traveling and so forth?
It would make it more efficient, but we can make that argument about when Constitution says you have the right to confront your accuser. Wouldn't it be more efficient if we left your accuser in Maryland and we did the trial in California and you had a telephonic hookup or a Zoom hookup? Wouldn't that be more efficient?
It seems like it would be, yes.
Yes, but that's not what Scalia says, that was meant by the confrontation. He says that the framers at the time, they weren't thinking about Zoom. They were thinking about you had the right to force the person to come in and say, yes, there sits the person who did that. And say it publicly in your presence, where you could cross-examine them, and that's the fear of this. Is there are a lot more efficient ways to do things, but efficiency isn't the goal in our system.
So this is something that is on the radar to be watching out for. That is a bad thing, huh? Overall, or just pieces of it. What?
Well, anytime you expand the careful balance of powers between the branches of government, and you give extraordinary powers to any particular, whether it be the executive or to the judicial branch, it's always scary because very few like to relinquish power once they have it. So if you look at our nation's history, there's a constant power struggle between the executive and the legislative and the judicial branch of trying to absorb more power. So I think that whatever powers that are ceded to various branches of government, they're going to have to come under scrutiny after this crisis abates, because I'm not sure we're ready to give up all, we're ready to concede all those new powers. I don't think people who fear a power grab are totally being unreasonable.
I understand. Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. When people get power, they generally don't want to give it away. That's for sure.
So,
well, let's move over to an article where the title is Third Federal Inmate Dies from COVID. This comes from NPR. And this is coming out of Oakdale, LA, Louisiana. I'm sorry. And that's like another hotbed of a flare-up of this virus, is specifically in Louisiana. So here we have the third federal inmate has died. Nicholas Rodriguez became ill on March 25th and had a high temperature. Being inside of these boxes, these prisons and jails, and having this virus spreading, there's so many movies that make this reference, Larry, and I'm sure you haven't seen them, but one of them that I think about is called Resident Evil, and, you know, one person gets bit, and then 5 minutes later, the whole ward is contaminated, and people are running around trying to kill everybody. It's obviously, this isn't that bad, other than the death part, but it's just horrible.
Well, we all knew this was coming, and Brenda, I think, pointed out last week that it's almost too little too late. I mean, I'd say we shouldn't continue to try to reduce the population, but Say, hypothetically, if we had been able and willing to cut the population of our prisons by half, wouldn't you be able to put enough distance between? You would have less stress on the systems that exist in prison. You'd be able to do more laundry. You'd be able to hand out more hand sanitizers and cleansers. You'd be able to do a lot of things if you had the population. A lot of stress would go off of the correctional facility. Had we moved quickly and cut the population in half and not been so terrified of laying people out on alternative means of supervision, would we have been able to have a different result? It'll take a lot of studying, like self-introspection, to figure out if we could have done more once this is all done and we see how many people in prisons die. But it's likely to be a substantial number.
Certainly. But even if we dropped it by half, Larry, I'm thinking about the different units that I was in. Other than being in a cell house where you are already maybe in a two-man cell and you drop it by half, you at least now have your own cell. But if you're in one of these big open dormitories, and you've got the last open dorm that I was in had capacity for, call it 50 people, and they stacked 70 in there. So even if you dropped it by half, you're still practically sitting on top of each other already. It wouldn't really change the equation all that much.
Well, but let's say that you did, what's recommended, assuming the bunks are not connected to the floor, but say you move the bunks at least 6 feet apart, and then say you took the person off the top bunk and they were still person on the top bunk, and you got the capacity down to that level, and then say you actually put a whole bunch of sanitizer and you change their laundry out every day, and say you did all these things, and of course that doesn't take into account who's going to be coming in and out from the outside, but say you did all those things, would that make any difference? I don't know. I'm not a medical expert. I'm wondering, though. It poses the question. What we do know is if we take half the people out, they wouldn't have caught it in prison. We can say unequivocally that. Wouldn't we be able to conclude that if we reduce the population by half, we can unequivocally say that if you leave the prison without being infected, you will not catch it in prison?
Oh, totally. I mean, yeah, if you weren't there to catch it, then you certainly didn't catch it there. You caught it out on the street.
So that would be one of the knowns that we would know. We would save the risk of prison spread to those people that we let out.
Doesn't that kind of segue into the next article from the Crime Reporter? Says, after the COVID-19 release of prisoners, who will help them? I know that in Georgia, when you get out, you get $25 and a bus ticket. I don't think that they're handing you any more resources just because they released you because of the COVID crisis.
I don't think they would be either, but do you still get the paper suit that they used to give you in Georgia?
What paper suit? Like the
They used
jumpsuit?
To give you like a really, really, really cheap set of clothing. Do they still give you a set of clothing?
Depending on if you're at state or private prisons. If you're at private prisons, you get scrubs, just like, scrunchy pants, whatever, and just a pullover. But if you're at the state ones, you get like almost like a suit. People call it the monkey suit.
A what?
A monkey suit. But it's just that white outfit with a blue stripe down the side. And then the
Oh, yeah. Actually, those are not the worst uniforms at all. I would rather wear that than the arch jumpsuits.
Yes, definitely that. A big giant onesie.
But in terms of the article, this does pose someone who's been in prison for any reasonable period of time, any long period of time. If you went on this massive empty prisons that I was talking about, how would we help these people? Would we just say you're free to go and take your chances and hope for the best because we don't want you to be infected here? But where would they go and who would help them? If you've been locked up for 12 years, you don't have anything to connect to. If they just simply open the gate and say good luck to you.
Yeah, that almost doesn't sound any different than what, the normal release of someone that doesn't have anywhere to go would be.
So, but I wonder if prisons have suspended the charges for seeing medical, for the last couple of decades, they've been on, wow. Particularly in the South, they've been on this kick of suppressing people's use of the medical facilities to charge them a copay. I wonder if they're, if you say I'm feeling sick, I've got a fever, if you go to the sick call, if they're suspending the copays now in view of the health crisis.
I'm inclined to say no, being that they charge for everything. I'm certain that they didn't like post out some order that says if you've got symptoms of this, then you don't have to pay them.
Well, wouldn't that discourage people, or would it not?
Absolutely. That's the whole intent, is to discourage people from just needlessly going there just to get out of the dorm and go see, civilians. That's totally the intent on that part of it.
Well, I thought that unless you needed to see the doctor, that the that the, that the sick call came to you, I thought they had roving nurses that pushed these carts around, and they had the basic medical equipment of thermometers and blood pressure cups and stuff like that, and Tylenol and ibuprofen and stuff like that that they could dispense, and that they brought the medical to you. Is that not the way they do it?
Not what I saw in the, you know, and this is now a good number of years ago. Kind of seems weird that I would say that now, but no, if for that they would do a pill call, and then you would go march up to the central dispensary for you to go get your pills, and you'd wait in line to get your Thorazine, and then come back to the dorm and then go to shower. You did it on your way back, whichever way that worked. But no, there wasn't somebody roaming around with a pill cart, because that would get knocked over and all the pills stolen.
Well, how would it do that? They wouldn't roam around by themselves. They would roam around under supervision of guards. They wouldn't just start pushing a cart around, but that's what I recollect.
Let me tell you a story about the last place I was at. Like almost like on the day that I arrived, they had the camp locked down, and I just happened to have like a window view. There was a dude running around on the roof. The way the dorms were, they were almost like A-frame kind of dorms, like, you know, just a high top roof looking thing. And somebody had found an area where they could get up on the roof, and he was having a standoff because he said, "No, screw this. I'm not complying with whatever he was supposed to comply with." But he was on the roof, walking around.
Well, did they shoot him off the roof?
No, I assume they just waited him out, because eventually he was like, "Well, I guess I'm going to get cold, or I'm going to get hungry, or, you know, something." So I guess they eventually talked him down, but that's Georgia doesn't really have a very good control over their prisons. I'll tell you that.
Well, I'm surprised.
I'm sure there's some sarcasm there on that.
I thought Georgia had the most progressive, forward thinking, well managed yes. correctional system in the whole United States.
That is certainly the Georgia. Certainly the Georgia. Was there another article that we wanted to cover about the COVID crisis?
Well, I think that the one where they're rethinking their rules about supervision, it was somewhere in there in this mix of 100 articles.
I'm moving it. I'm moving it right now. I'm moving it right now.
I'm hoping this is the beginning of a trend. And I say this now, saying that I hope it's the beginning of a trend, and I'll end up having to regret it later because they'll abuse it. But it seems like the adjustments that they are making now to meet with people with, what do you call it, FaceTime and Skype, or all yeah, sure. these different things are that they're using, would be a positive direction, because as a supervised individual, particularly if they visit with you on your job, people lose their jobs because of the commotion that these people cause. I mean, you're running a workplace. You don't want a Gestapo unit to come in with people carrying guns and demanding to see the supervisor and demanding to interrupt the workplace, and I'm hoping that this less intrusive supervision is something that doesn't go away after the virus. You can still do your random UAs, your analysis. You can still do those things, just because you're not requiring face to face. I mean, that you can do a random your analysis. That I don't know enough about flushing your system, but I think that if you've got drugs in your system, and they give you 4 hours to get to the drug, is that enough time for you to purge your system?
I think you can take stuff, but I don't know if it purges your system. I think it's something that you have to do on some kind of regular basis. But I will tell you this from personal experience. I knew that I hadn't had my second visit of the month, and then all this stuff started happening. And I had my visit like early in the month before all the crap started happening. And randomly, like on the third to last day of March, my phone rings. Hey, how you doing? Fine. Anything? Any interaction with law enforcement? Anything like? Nope. Cool. So they did my visit by phone. Why is that different all of a sudden? Like, they could have been doing that the whole time, but no, they want to come out and knock on my door and come in and check out and see if I've got any booze in the fridge. Just for the record, I don't ever drink ever, but that's what they come look for.
So you can have a relapse, but this is from the Marshall Project, and it says 50 reform-minded probation parole officer chiefs called last week. Now, 50 is a significant number. It's not like some outlier when you've got 50 chiefs called for states and counties to suspend or severely limit jailing people for supervision violations that aren't crimes. I mean, I love that, because we shouldn't be jailing so many people anyway that haven't committed a new crime. The technical arrests are just over the top. And I was listening to a program of an organization on the talk radio before I came in to do this recording today, and an organization I'll leave nameless that professes to help offenders reintegrate. And they were bragging about their 4% a recidivism rate. And then they said the nationwide average stat on recidivism is 83%. And I just barfed when I heard that, because that's taken into account technical violations. I haven't even seen 83%. But even if it is that high, it's all violations. So if an interviewer asked me that, what is the recidivism rate of your program? I would first say, well, define recidivism. Do you mean being arrested for a new crime?
Yes.
Do you mean being convicted of a new crime? Or do you mean having to go back into custody for something that was not totally compliant with the conditions of supervision, which can be very easily violated? So what? Let's define recidivism, and then I'll give you our rate. But I was distressed to hear this organization talking about this fantastic 4% recidivism, and then talking about the national average is 83%. But back to this article, this is phenomenal if you've got this many chiefs urging caution, because after this crisis ends, hopefully this will spill over and they'll say the world didn't come to an end. People are actually, law enforcement entities are reporting lower crime rates. Have you been following that?
I haven't, but it seems the reason that people aren't going out.
Yeah, the crime rate is down. I mean, the scam type crimes are going up off the charts. People trying to convince you then get your stimulus payment now, and people trying to hack. I mean, this is a hacker's paradise, I'm told, because I guess the overload of everybody being on the internet is causing stresses that I can't even begin to talk about. But in terms of overall street crime and things that happen in the way of property crimes, those rates are plummeting.
Yep. Yeah. So the answer to our crime problem is to keep everybody locked up at home.
Well, I don't know if that I would equate
locked up
that
somewhere.
But I think that just simply letting people out of custody, and we haven't let out nearly enough in my opinion, but relaxing the enforcement and doing the token things that they've done so far in view of this crisis has not resulted in the tidal wave of crime that people would normally say would happen if you do these things. And there was a sensational story on the local news last night of a person who was released from jail pursuant to a motion, because he says he has a health situation that makes him vulnerable, and the judge agreed. And the local station decided to vilify the judge who did that, because he's re-victimized the victims.
So very bizarre, Larry. So very bizarre. I have provided by my sensational co-host a clip of the late, great Antonin Scalia, and I will be happy to play it if you are ready to hear it.
Let's set it up first.
Please do.
Let's set it up. I found this accidentally, and I listen to Scalia a lot, so I find things, and then I'm too lazy to write down where I found it at, and I almost had to give up on finding it again for today, but I found this as I was thinking about the stimulus package and the 2.2 to 6 trillion. And nobody seems to know what this thing's going to cost. And it's the stimulus package number 3. Now they're working on number 4. And it really hit me that of all the stimulus efforts that we're hearing, I haven't heard much that really addresses the poor people. You know, all this is designed, if you study it and you do it with an open mind, the conservatives, primarily the Republicans, are really stressing to save business, because business is important and we can't lose our great companies. And I don't fundamentally disagree with that. The companies are important. We don't want to lose basic industry. We don't want to lose. But then the Democrats have been talking about saving the middle class. You know, these are people who've been working and up until the shutdown orders, and they have really focused on business and the middle class. But I've heard so little about the poor people, who are even more vulnerable, because the conditions that you describe in jail is what shelters are generally like. If you've ever been in a shelter that does homeless people, if you're lucky enough to be able to be in a shelter, they're usually rows and rows of bunks, and they're very crowded. And then people who don't stay at shelters, they're on the streets living in the elements, and not able to sanitize themselves regularly. And I've heard not even the progressives talking much about helping the poor people. But they've gone to great lengths to make these things quick. We got to get the money to people quick. We've got to get to the businesses quick. We've got to get the payroll protection plan money to keep people on the payrolls quick. And we've got to get the stimulus checks to people quick. And the Treasury Secretary is being chastised for saying that people that are on disability and retirement benefits should even have to dare to file a return to get their money. We want to remove all barriers to getting the extra $600 a week of unemployment. And we've got to just take people's word and give them the money and we'll straighten this out later. And that's such a contrast to how we treat the poor people who rely on the real poverty programs, which are SNAP, food stamps, or TANF, temporary aid to needy families. We build every barrier we can around those programs. And many of the southern states require drug testing. And they require that you engage in all these work requirements, that you be enrolled in these in employment training programs. And I'm not pronouncing whether they're good or bad, but we seem to fault the people that they're in these positions and the predicaments they're in. And we found it's a whole different attitude when we're giving money to the middle class. And so Scalia validated what I think about where most of our money that we shovel to people in this country goes to the middle class. So that's the backdrop for this clip. He's giving a lecture, and this is just a little over a minute of a 30-minute lecture talk that he gives.
Finally, I may mention that even the seeming Christian virtue of socialism, that it means well and seeks to help the poor, even that seeming Christian virtue may be greatly exaggerated. It is true in the United States, and I believe it is true in all of the Western democracies, that the vast bulk of social spending does not go to the poor, but rather to the middle class, which also happens to be the class most numerous at the polls. The most expensive entitlement programs, Social Security and Medicare, for example, overwhelmingly benefit those who are not in dire financial straits. So one may plausibly argue that welfare state democracy does not really have even the Christian virtue of altruism. The majority does not say to the rich, give your money to the poor, but rather, give your money to us. Just as I believe the left is not necessarily endowed with Christian virtue, so also I believe the right is not necessarily bereft of it. Laissez-faire capitalism, like socialism, speaks to the degree of involvement of the state in the economic life of the society. Like socialism also, it does not speak to the nature of the human soul.
Can you translate that to English?
Oh, well, you'd have to listen to more of the presentation, but he's not really saying one way or the other. He's speaking to religious group, and he's talking about how the government the evaporation of private charity and more being done by the government and the pitfalls of what, you know, there was a time when the government giving any money to a private person was viewed as unconstitutional. But then the General Welfare Clause was interpreted more broadly to allow the federal government and governments in general to give money. But he's making the point that I'm trying to make here about the welfare state. We do have a welfare state in this country, but it's largely for the middle class. And the people in the middle class, they don't like to think of themselves as being. I had a visitor from Omaha, Nebraska, that just almost disowned the relationship with me because the person said, I'm receiving Social Security and I resent that being called an entitlement. I said, well, why do you resent it being called an entitlement? I said, that's exactly what it is. I said, you paid.
If there's anything that's going to be one, that is the true definition of entitlement.
I said, you contributed to it at the rate that you were asked to contribute for the years that you were in the workforce. And in exchange for that, those contributions, you were promised a commitment by the people that are working today that they would pay you. And you're entitled to it by virtue of reaching a certain age or being disabled or the various things that are qualified under Social Security. You're entitled to it by law. It doesn't have to be appropriated. We don't have to vote each year whether to fund Social Security. You are, as a matter of right, entitled to receive those benefits. I said, I don't know why you don't think you're on entitlement. Of course you're on an entitlement. That's exactly what you're on. And Scalia is making the point about what I'm trying to make about the stimulus. We have created this gigantic unfunded stimulus, and the overwhelming majority of it will never get anywhere near a poor person. Now, they technically are eligible for the $1,200 if they have a Social Security number. If they have a Social Security number and they're not already receiving Social Security benefits, then they're going to have to file a return according to the latest guidance from the Treasury, and they're entitled to the $1,200. But the things that we could be doing if we were really as generous as a society as we think we are, we would be trying to figure out how to get these people more adequate shelter now, because they're so much more vulnerable while this pandemic is running rampant. But there's barely a twerp out there about the homeless population. Have you heard anything in Georgia about the homeless? I haven't.
No, but I'm just wondering, did you just call me a twerp?
I said there's been barely a twerp about it. I haven't heard. I think in Florida, I think I sent you something where they put up 100 pup tents for homeless. Yes. And they
excluded the registrants.
The PFRs are not allowed in the tents.
Correct.
But our country, we just need to take a good look at ourselves and realize that, yes, we all depend on one another. This system that we have, that where we think we do it all ourselves, no, we actually don't. We all depend on one another. And it's important, should be important to all of us to see to it that every person is functioning at their optimal capability so that they can make a contribution to society. And we've just written off hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people as being just worthless, and we've turned our backs on them. But it's amazing that this big multi-trillion-dollar stimulus, no telling how much more to come, all on borrowed money, let me add, that we're certainly taking good care of the middle class.
But as he said in there, the middle class is the largest voting group?
That's correct.
Is that why? But I mean, the middle class, is this a correct statement? And I've heard it, and I hope I regurgitate it right. The middle class is what drives the economy?
Well, I would agree. It's the driver of the economy. But let's try to make sure that we don't write people off. I've got this strange notion that out of the million or whatever number of total homeless out there, there's an immense amount of wasted talent that could be channeled to for the betterment of society. And I don't believe that you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps once you're down to nothing. Whether or not you made a bad decision does not change the fact that once you're in that predicament, the people who now are, by no fault of their own, they're finding themselves in a bad situation. And they didn't control the fact that this virus resulted in them getting laid off. But they did control the decisions on what they did in terms of how they managed their money that they didn't hold on to any of up until this crisis hit. You don't have to have the best of everything. You could do some savings, right? Most people have a little bit of capacity to save.
Most people do, but I don't know that most people exercise, even if they have that capacity.
Right, but under the pure, I hear from the libertarians that constantly say, well, I don't like paying for that. Couldn't I just be just as harsh right now and say, well, gee, I think I can ride this out, and I actually think I can, depending on if it gets, I don't, with what they're predicting in terms of length of, if it's 18 months, I think I can ride it out. Shouldn't I be able to say, I don't want to pay for you? Isn't that what they say about these poor people? I don't want to pay for these people.
You just jogged my memory about something that I was listening to, a program from WNYC. It's called The Brian Lehrer Show. And a woman called in. She owns, I think, 30-something units in New York City. And she says, well, I don't want my tenants not paying rent. I have a $22,000 property tax bill I've got to pay in, you know, the coming days, weeks, months, whatever. And I'm like, you should have thought about that before. You know, I'd be like, why didn't you have that money saved already? So I was like, well, we can flip that table around all day long. And like, well, you should have prepared for it. Oh, you should have prepared for it. We can't all be Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and have $100 billion in the bank.
That's correct. And we are all in this. All of a sudden, we're hearing this. You listen to our governor. It's what we can do together. And I'm saying the same thing. It's what we can do together to separate ourselves from one another. And it's what we can do together to try to put this crisis behind us. But when I hear taxpayer money, folks, don't delude yourself. This is not taxpayer money. We are borrowing this money. This is not taxpayer money. And although I do support it, and amazingly, I sent you an article about how conservatives have magically done an about face on this stimulus, Did you get the one I sent you earlier today that about how the conservatives magically afford this stimulus that have been against all previous stimulus programs?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing that they've done such an about face, but it is not taxpayer money. Had we balanced the budget and been running a surplus, we would have some cushion right now if we hadn't have done the gigantic tax cut that blew a hole in revenues, and if we hadn't have increased spending, particularly in the area of military and national security. If spending hadn't been going up at such a rapid clip of almost 10%, we would have more of a cushion to work with right now. But we're going to borrow so much money. And who knows where the national debt is going to end up after this subsides when this is over. I believe there'll be another stimulus coming very shortly because this is an election year. And when people are going to be facing the electorate, they're going to make sure that they're shoveling as much money as they can to the voters, is what Scalia said.
And there's a difference in the mentality of if the money is flowing towards me, that's really freaking awesome. But if it's flowing towards you and you fill in whoever you is, then no, I don't want to pay for it.
That is correct. That's the selfishness about this. But the people, I doubt very many people are going to refuse their stimulus payments. And
I'm not.
I don't have any intention of doing so either. But isn't
shouldn't I be able to choose? Like, I mean, I'm not going to save it. It probably, you know, it's not going to be immediately used to pay my rent either, because fortunately, I happen to have a job that's secure, it would seem. And, you know, and I know that can change on a dime. But I'm just going to go turn around, particularly when things open back up, and I'm going to start going back to restaurants, and I'm going to start to buy more stuff. I mean, like, it's going to get used in the economy as soon as things open back up. I can't do anything right now.
Well, of course you can.
I mean, I can, but it's not like, I mean, I don't go to movies, but I can't go to the movies. I can't go sit out at a restaurant and hang out with my friends. I can't do any of that because, I mean, I created a Discord server for my meetup group so that we could have some sort of video conference. We didn't go to the local pizza joint, hang out and eat wings and stuff.
So, well, one more point before I beat this horse to death. It's good that we have recognized that when the economy is in a contraction, we need to provide stimulus. I just wish we had recognized that back in 2009 when they referred to it as the porculus. And very few, if any, Republicans voted for the $787 billion porculus, as they called it. And it was largely a partisan affair trying to get stimulus. And they complained about the anemic recovery of the economy, which it did not boom like previous recoveries had. We ultimately did recover. But they kept a very tight control over federal spending, as that chart that I put in the articles below shows. If you look at the fourth one, it says the balance.com U.S. government spending. It shows the chart during the Obama years, and then it shows the chart during the Trump years, and it shows the chart of the 2 years before Obama, the rapid increases in spending. And that's part of what helps an economy rebound is stimulus. And so amazingly, they're for stimulus now. They were against it then, and that did hinder our economic recovery and rebound from the Great Recession of 2009.
Other than that chart, is there anything in these 3, 4, 5 articles that you put in here about the spending stuff and the deficit and budget?
Well,
realizing that this is the Registry Matters policy budget podcast.
I wanted to show what a pittance we spend on food stamps, SNAP benefits compared to the overall budget, and what I thought was going to be a 50-year chart. It opened for me once, but it's not opening again. It's behind a paywall, but it showed the spending, and actually spending on SNAP has been going down, and it should have been going down because of the recovery, but also of tightened eligibility and work requirements. But we're spending somewhere between $70 to $90 billion with a B a year out of a multi-trillion-dollar deficit. The bulk of our money, as Justice Scalia said, is spent on things that don't provide relief to the poor. And it's a myth. It's a sad myth that we focus so much on the really small amount that this Western democracy spends on direct aid to the poor. And it would do nothing to plug our budget deficit if we totally eliminated that and temporary assistance to needy families, which is the largest program that helps families with children. If we eliminate both of those, we would still have a massive budget hole.
Yeah, that's a disturbingly small amount of money that is spent there. And that's considered discretionary, correct?
Yes.
And I'm pretty sure if we wiped out 100% of discretionary spending, it would not come anywhere close to filling the budget?
Well, it would go a long way because the military is also discretionary.
Is that right?
But the military is almost $1 trillion when you add in the direct defense budget, and then all the things that support the military establishment, the national security apparatuses and stuff. You're talking about approaching $1 trillion. But you can't eliminate those things. I mean, if we were to cut the military by one dime, Saddam would be here tomorrow. I mean, you do understand that, don't you?
I believe that I've heard that before.
Yes. I mean, now disregard the fact that we spend more than the next 7 wealthiest nations all combined. Never mind that true reality. And never mind that we have what the president refers to as the strongest military on earth. But if we were to cut anything from the military budget, all life as we know it would end.
You always paint such rosy pictures, Larry. You are the doom and gloom version of this podcast.
There's just a lot of numbers in those articles about the budget. If people want to get into the nuances, but we're not the budget podcast here.
Skynet has become self-aware.
can we talk about this being like a total technology power grab for our citizenry from our governments?
We can. I love that.
This article comes from the Washington Post. The coronavirus is expanding the surveillance state. How will this play out? I frankly have been thinking about just that generally people have GPS stuff turned on their phone. Google generally and others know generally where you are, if not down to, you know, like the intersection and like the house number. So it seems like they would have an idea of where people are, building heat maps and figure out roughly who may have been infected and, you know, put those pieces together. And we could isolate the people and inform them. You know, if you're in the middle of Nebraska and you haven't been near anybody that has tested positive, then you're probably pretty safe in general. So anyway, this is all of the technology that's coming down the pike here. This article is talking about how all the cameras, all of the, certain states, some countries have apps that they require you have on your phone. It's disturbing to a large degree.
Apps that you're required to have on your phone?
Yes, some countries, not the United States.
Okay,
but China, Singapore, Israel has done some pretty shady stuff lately that are all about some surveillance state stuff, so they can keep an eye on the population. I'm sure you've heard of the China social credit. I think that's what it's called. Have you heard of that?
The what?
It's called the. I want to say it's called the social credit. I'm sure Brenda can fine tune that one if I have it wrong. But they're tracking your credit, your criminal history, how you pay your bills. And so many things, and you could be denied getting tickets onto the train if your social credit score, I think is what it's called, goes below a certain mark.
I don't believe I've heard that one.
Oh, it's very bizarre. And their population, from what I hear, is generally on board with it because who wants to sit on the train with the oogie person that doesn't pay their bills? Sounds just like something else that we have in the United States to me. So they'll even post your sign up on like the New York Times, not New York Times, the Times Square big billboard. They'll post people's pictures up there to publicly shame them. Yeah, I can't believe you haven't heard of this.
I'm having trouble getting the CNBC one to open. I thought it opened earlier. I never could get the Washington Post open because of the paywall, but I was having trouble getting the CNBC to open.
Someday, Larry, we are going to get you to stop using Internet Explorer. And I'm not cutting that from the podcast. But the CNBC article's use of surveillance to fight coronavirus raises concerns about government power after pandemic ends. China mobilized its mass surveillance tools from drones to CCTV cameras to monitor quarantine people and track the spread of coronavirus. I think we have an article that talks about GPS monitoring the plague-stricken people.
Are we doing that?
I have heard it. I saw a picture somewhere that talked about it, but I don't remember where I saw it in actuality. Maybe that's from another country too. Just you know, employing the myriad of tools that could be available to deal with this until we get a vaccine.
So, well, I did read the Snowden article, and I thought that was fascinating from Business Insider.
Yep.
The Israel, and granted its spy services, emergency powers to hack citizens' phones without a warrant. South Korea has been sending text alerts to warn people when they have been in contact with a coronavirus patient.
You know, where's that balance? If I'm not saying it's the government's responsibility, but, you know, we get Amber Alerts. Shouldn't we be welcoming of having information that could potentially help us avoid, particularly in this case, the coronavirus? I mean,
well,
saying our government is not to absolutely protect us from anything, but at the same time, it is one of their primary functions is to protect us.
Well, South Korea has been sending text alerts to warn people when they've been in contact with a coronavirus patient, including personal details like age and gender. Now, doesn't that kind of spring from the sex offender registry when people say, don't I have a right to know? If you're encountering a person that the government is tracking, that they know that they have this infection, wouldn't the logical shoot off from that be that you have the right to know? I mean, you have this, the big bad government, you know this. Why don't I have the right to know this? You know it.
The similarities between this whole lockdown and certain curfews and just the various restrictions harken so, the irony is so unbelievably crazy to me of how, I don't want to be locked down. I mean, I need to go out and do my stuff. But, I mean, that's what our people do every day of their lives just about, is have to worry about who's going to see them and recognize them, chastise them for being out. It's like, it's just, all of the similarities are just so funny to me.
We are going to have a massive discussion in this country after this is abated, after it has abated. We're going to have a massive discussion about how much of this we're willing to give up of our privacy and what rights we do have, because I'm not sure you do have the right to know a person's medical condition.
That's why that whole HIPAA regulation thing exists, right?
Yeah, but I'm not sure you don't either. If they're a hazard, like I said, I'm not sure. We're going to have an intense discussion about where that balancing act comes, because as the libertarians are so fond of saying, they don't want hardly any regulation. They don't want the government telling anything. Well, I think that's absurd, but where's that balance?
I was having a conversation that I was having. This is similar to smoking in that I'm completely repulsed by being in the presence of someone that is smoking because, A, it's disgusting in general. But when they exhale, there's this horrible smell that comes about. And if you hearken that smell to being having the Black Death put upon you by them exhaling or sneezing in your proximity, like, I mean, you know, it's just, it's very, it changes it from being something that's very invisible to something that is very visible. But it's the same thing. Like, well, you're outside. F you. I can smoke when I'm outside, right? Well, no, because I still have to breathe the air that you've just contaminated with carcinogens and poisons, as opposed to the person that is infected with this deadly disease, this deadly virus, that if you breathe and I contract it, I could then potentially die. That's a tough balancing act. It's not like somebody's walking around with cancer. Cancer is not contagious. This is highly, highly, highly contagious.
Well, the crime report goes into even further about, will privacy be a casualty of the pandemic?
Yep. What do you think? Do you think that you as a policy wonk can, is it in your forte to even navigate these kinds of conversations?
It's hard for me to navigate these conversations until we know what the outcome is, where we can actually have the conversation about. We've had a lot of conversation about 9/11, and we've concluded that a lot of what we've given up, I mean, you can't see your loved one to the gate of an airplane anymore. That's no big deal. We're willing to give that up. You have to be imaged, which goes down to every minute detail of your body, shapes and sizes, and it results in a pretty thorough hand pat down if they see any shape that doesn't look right. We've had that discussion, and we've decided to be safe. It's worth it. So at this point, since we don't know what we're being safe from and we don't know the magnitude, if it turns out that the 250,000 number dead is the right number, the conversation is going to take on one course of the people say, well, it clearly was worth it. It would have been 2.5 million had we not done this. But if there's some magic solution that comes about, or the warming weather and this goes away, the discussion is going to take on another course in terms of the policy ramifications of ordering businesses to shut down. We have decimated businesses that, despite I think our best efforts to save them, we won't be able to resurrect some businesses that, depending on how long the shutdowns go. So there's going to be an intense discussion about what's happened after this has passed us.
Yeah, I'm sure there are even subjects that no one has even thoroughly contemplated yet, too.
And I think that of those discussions are going to be very good, because emergency preparedness, for one, is it would have been a tough sell to convince appropriators to appropriate large sums of money for equipment and supplies. I think for the next few years, that won't be such a tough sell. Yeah, as our memories are fresh, we're going to be willing. I mean, we since 9/11, there has been nothing. If you look at every national security appropriation, whether it be direct military spending, or whether it be the NSA, or whether it be Department of Homeland Security, whether it be the Transportation Security Administration, you pick your alphabet. All of those have gone consistently up. Our desire to spend more and more money has not gone down for what is it, almost 20 years now. So 2001, yeah. We're in 2020, so we're approaching two decades. So I think that we are going to be willing to spend a little bit more on public health, and probably for the foreseeable future. But I guess always when I say we're willing to spend more, I always like the coupling that, well, are we willing to tax ourselves to pay for that? Because you can't call it taxpayer funds when you're not paying the taxes to fund the spending, and I resent that, because we're spending a fourth more than what we're taxing before this calamity hit. So you can't call it taxpayer spending. It isn't taxpayer spending.
Well, let me just share this with you. Is that I was talking to someone, and so she's been furloughed, and then she says, "Well, am I going to get the $1,200 check?" I said, "As far as I know, I mean, it's, you know, if you've been filing your taxes, it should be here probably by the end of April, give or take." She goes, "Well, am I going to have to pay it back?" And I'm like, it's a weird question. Like, I mean, we're going to have to pay it back eventually. It's just not going to come off your actual like tax bill next year. They're not going to add $1,200 to it next year. But I mean, I presume we're going to have to pay it back.
No, we don't. We don't pay back the national debt.
We should at some point, right?
Well, should. But since World War II, we ran some surpluses during the Truman, and I think we might have had a surplus or two of the Eisenhower administration, but then we went on deficit spending at a much smaller scale for the better part of four decades until the late 90s, when we actually balanced the budget and ran some surpluses. And then since the 90s, we haven't run a surplus. So the accumulated national debt, it seldom drops. It continues to go up, and that's why they have these discussions about raising the debt limit. But if we were being responsible, we would in fact want to pay off the debt, because it has to be serviced, and interest on the national debt, even at these low rates that we're paying today, the interest on the national debt is hundreds of billions of dollars. We're paying $300 or $400 billion in interest. If we weren't paying that service cost on the debt, that would be $300 to $400 billion of money we could be spending on a recurring basis.
Are we ready to move past all this?
Yeah, I'm sick of this about finance.
This article comes from law.com, and it's Sotomayor bowing to futility. "I will cease noting my dissent in sentencing dispute." She's thrown in the towel, Larry, about, I think the way that I read this, and you're going to have to clarify, I think people have been sentenced under a law that has been then changed and ruled unconstitutional, yet the Supreme Court will not grant cert to hear their case to have the change applied to them. I think that's what I understood from this article.
I think you're right. I put it in there for a different, I had a more sinister motivation. I had someone say that I was being remiss for not reading dissents. And I said, well, I typically don't spend a lot of energy on them at the Supreme Court level, because they really don't mean a whole lot. And I was trying to illustrate the point. When a justice who's in the dissenting minority on a particular issue over and over again, when she says, "I'm not even going to bother," that's the whole point I was making, is that the dissent on a Supreme Court It makes a difference when it's like in the Maryland case that we were going to talk about today. The Maryland case, it makes a difference because the court is almost evenly divided. So when you have a 5-4 split, the dissent is more relevant. When it's 6-3 or 7-2, 8 or 9-0, well, you wouldn't have a dissent of 9-0, but it's 8-1. If you got a dissenting anything short, it doesn't matter because that's great that they don't agree, but they can't do anything about it. And so that was the point I put this in here for. She's not going to waste the effort anymore because she realized that she's hopelessly going to be talking to the walls until there's a change in the makeup of the Supreme Court on this particular issue. It's not going to be worth dissenting anymore because nobody cares.
But shouldn't she still dissent, even if it's like boilerplate, just copy and paste? Because she's not going to do anything, but at least she's making her position known.
Well, she says that it's not worth the effort. So
she's not going to waste her energy and move on to dealing with issues of higher court.
And I can't get past the paywall on this. So we've had our three articles, I think.
Yes, we have. We might want to pay for law.com. Let's move over to the New York Times. Tell me, what does Rush call this one?
Oh, the New York Times?
Yes.
Well, he has, I think he calls it the Slimes, but I'm not sure.
Okay, that's what I thought. I just wanted to hear you channel your inner Rush. This is the Iowa Republican governor, Kim Reynolds, 20 years ago got caught up in some DUI kind of things, and she was granted some leniency, and she wants to have a change of heart for the legislature to let people have some criminal justice reform out in that part of the country.
Restore the right to vote, I believe this is about. As she thinks felons should have the right to vote. And I think Iowa's one of those states that where you're permanently disenfranchised.
Let's see. Do you think that people should be able, like, where do you fall down on this one? So we have two states where you can vote while in prison. Do you think that we should go that far?
I haven't really, from a policy point of view, I don't see a problem with it, but there's the practicality of doing elections in prisons, you know, being that we go through this kabuki of registering voters. So you've got to have a whole separate registration process. Person's in prison 24 years, and you say, okay, you can vote. You got lifetime in prison. You got to vote. Well, we've got to create a precinct at the prison. We've got to do a lot of stuff. From a practical point of view, it seems like it would be cumbersome, but I don't really have a problem with people voting. They're all going to vote conservative anyway. So I don't see, I mean, we've proven that over and over again with research that's been done. So the conservatives ought to get with a plan. They can pick up a whole bunch of votes if they'll open up letting people be convicted of crimes vote. They'll find out that their margins will be a whole lot stronger.
Interesting. Yeah. They run store call, and this wouldn't be too different than running store call. You know, they let you out in some sort of organized fashion to go to some place where you have turned in your slip and you pick up your goods and so forth. I mean, the operation wouldn't be too different. Obviously, there are other logistics things involved, but seems if they wanted to, they could.
Oh, I know they could because states were doing it. But states that do it are known to be more willing to spend money. If you looked at what those states spend on prisoners, it's probably a little bit more than Alabama and Georgia. In terms of the per person.
We already know that for sure. Probably like to the order of twofold.
But you do have logistical problems because guards are not trained in being you have to be certified to be a voter registrar. You have to go through training in most states to register voters. So we've got to train our staff. We've got to set up a polling process. And so on election day, do you let everybody go to the gymnasium and vote at the polls like they would if they were in the free world? It is a logistical problem. I'm not saying it can't be overcome, and I don't have any problem with pushing for that off the top. I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with it, but you've got to set up infrastructure. Trying to change the way things are done in prison and do anything different that's going to cost money and require a different way of thinking is going to be hard.
No kidding.
You know, that's why things stay the way they are. Change is difficult. But I like this this article she's kind of fighting uphill because the GOP controls the legislature, and she wants to end the Iowa status as now the only state that permanently bars felons from voting. I'm a firm believer, quote, I'm a firm believer that you can make a mistake, but that shouldn't define you, she said in an interview. Gee, that's kind of what we say.
I believe so.
So
well, it's she, I dropped an article in there, and then you actually told me about one on the affiliates list about part of the stimulus bill and then some of the exclusions that are out there. And so, yeah, finally, we're going to talk about something related to the registry. And here it is that if you are convicted of a whole slew of different crimes that are sexual offenses, that the stimulus money for small businesses will not be something that you can receive. And then some people in these comments, Larry, if I don't know if you've read them, but if you have maybe like your spouse be the owner of the business, even though that person never does anything with the business, that somehow that's fraudulent. Or if you put the business in somebody else's name, that's fraudulent, even though they have nothing to do with it. It seems like you could figure out an easy way-ish around this, but maybe not.
Well, this is so tragic because I see this in everything. We take a lot of grief at Narsil for apparently people don't think we're aggressive enough. But everything that comes down the pike, even the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, in terms of early release for the crisis, they exempted practically everything that has to do with sexual offending. You know, how do we turn this around?
It has something to do with how we vote, right?
But if we're about saving business and people, the PFRs are employing people, I thought that's what we stood for. I thought we wanted to keep business alive.
I don't see why we would, like, I can understand some of the, I can at least like conceptually understand why certain restrictions are in place. This one doesn't really jive with me that if you're a small trucking company, if you've got 5 rigs and you're now shut down because the product that you were delivering isn't really in demand anymore. Maybe you're doing like hair care products or something and the salons are all shut down at the moment. Why should you be restricted from receiving the money so you can stay in business? I don't see how that's related to this at all, unless someone did a copy and paste. Oh, we don't want these people getting anything, so we're just going to paste it into the document.
That must be what they do, but I can't understand it because it goes contrary to, we want the economy running. Right? I thought that's what this was all about. And we want to save businesses, right? I thought that's what it was all about.
I just can't conceive of why this is there other than for some sinister motive, but other than even like of just copying and pasting it just because you're the asshole.
So
no one's going to oppose it.
I can't explain it, but it's tragic.
Well, fine, then we'll just move on. So here we are pretty much with like what would be the feature segment after 90 minutes, Larry. We are just shy of 90 minutes. This is from Legal News. State High Court rules sex offender registration qualifies as punishment. And Larry, I'm telling you, even just like from the title and then the subtitle, I'm confused right out of the gate. And I hope that you can explain it so that I understand it.
But before you go into it, we're going to be joined by Brenda Jones, who is the executive director of FAIR, which is the Maryland affiliate of Narsil. Hi, Brenda.
Hi there.
This guy in Maryland, this comes out of Maryland, and we have the case in the Registry Matters podcast show notes. It's Rogers versus Maryland, and there's a ton of yellow highlighting in the opinion. And I did not do anything in the dissent, so I don't need any emails. I know I didn't do anything in the dissent because this is Maryland's highest court, although it's called the Court of Appeals. There's nowhere else to take this to. So the only reason the dissent is relevant, because it's so closely divided, would be if there was a change of one justice, if one in the majority were to leave the court, and then one that thinks like the three in the minority were to be on the court, we could get a different outcome. But this case is really very simple. The person pled out a 5-count indictment, and they pled to a section of Maryland law that does not require that they register unless the offense is against a minor. So the criminal law article 11303A, it's a misdemeanor, and that's what he pled to. And registration is not required unless the trafficking, unless a crime was directed at a minor. And then 11303B is a felony. Now in Maryland, a misdemeanor can carry up to 10 years. So I don't want to make it sound light. We've got felonies that don't carry 10 years in New Mexico, and you get 10 years in Maryland for a misdemeanor. What the hell's wrong with you people up there? But anyway, the section B is enumerated as something that requires registration. So when Rogers did his plea, the court did not apprise him of a duty to register because there isn't one on the face of the statute. But the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services, the registry people, they decided that he would have to register. So they told him when he got out of prison that you need to register, and he didn't agree. And he did what we can't get one of our listeners to do, is to file a declaratory judgment. I'm picking on one of our listeners here. But he filed a petition for declaratory judgment, which is exactly what you should do. Rather than going back and reopening the criminal case and going back before the judge, he went to a civil court and said, declare under Maryland law whether or not I have to register. And the trial judge said, nope, you're right. The judge considered the declaratory judgment. Both sides asked for summary judgment, and summary judgment was granted. And the trial court said, you don't have to register. And the state, of course, appealed. And then their middle-level court of special appeals reversed the trial judge and said, do have to register. The individual, Rogers, he filed a cert petition, and the Supreme Court, which is actually, they call it the Court of Appeals, but their highest court, granted cert, and they agreed to decide the issue. And the essence is very simple. The legislature did not define an obligation to register unless the crime involved a minor. And since there was no representation during the plea process, there was no factual determination made by the trial court. There was nothing where the state proved that there was a minor involved, although we all know that from reading through this, that's exactly, but there was no proof. The agency was not allowed to make that determination. It was really that simple. The agency doesn't have the power to decide, absent any due process, to make a factual determination that wasn't decided in court. So therefore, he doesn't have to register. Now, I believe that the legislature will come back and fix this. And I know I'm not supposed to say stuff like this, but I believe that they will come back and they will just say that anyone who's convicted under either section of 11303, that that's a registrable offense, and that they'll be done with this. And then he'll get another notice that says, by the way, come on back in here and register. But as the law currently stands, the agency is not allowed to find that the crime involved a minor, and therefore he's directed to register. So that's how he won the case. Okay, so what have I missed in this discussion here?
Well, I think you did a pretty decent summary of it. I was trying to read it this morning. The thing that caught my eye in the first place, I mean, you summarized what it really does, but the thing that was catching my eye was the headline of the article was about how the law was declared punitive. And then the second paragraph was, this is the first time in the state of Maryland that the law, that Maryland's registry was declared punitive. And I thought, there's something wrong here, because Maryland's law got declared punitive, was it in 2012, 2013, when we had the first, yeah. And I'm like, there's something wrong. So I pulled out the dang decision, and I read almost all 24 pages of it, I do confess, of the primary decision. And sure enough, they do in fact say that the law is punitive, but they were doing it to prove that the separation of powers needed to be there, and they were not, that the Department of Public Safety did not have the authority to go around saying that this person had to register, because he had not, that they hadn't established that the fact of the being a victim, the victim was a minor during the court proceedings. And that, you know, so it's a separation of powers issue. Department of Public Safety couldn't come along and say, well, we happen to know that he got charged in this other thing and it was about a minor, so we're going to go ahead and put him on the registry. They weren't allowed to do that. It wasn't established as a, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt or one of those levels. So that was the big focus really of the decision as I was reading it. But the headlines made it sound like, woohoo, Maryland's registry has been declared punitive for the first time. I'm like, Say what? So that was what caught my attention.
Well, I think what it would, there's a lot of highlighted text in here, but there's one that when I tell people about the registry amendments and enhancements, the people, the legislators just can't help themselves that they believe that they can have a perpetual increase in requirements. So starting on page 14, where I have it highlighted, since 2009, the amendments, and it lists all the things that you have to do that tip the analysis. And we've had the discussion about Michigan, that Michigan couldn't stop, and they added stuff in 2006 and 2011. And there's something about lawmakers where no one says, look, you people just can't do this. If you do this, you're going to crash the damn thing that you're trying to protect, because those liberal pointy head people are going to come in and sue us, and we're going to lose because we cannot inflict punishment through a civil regulatory scheme. End of discussion. We can't impose all these things on people as a part of the regulations. We can do that. You can do more things when you're punishing them and the actual penalty, but you can't come back and keep stacking. And that's what they keep doing.
But why can't they pull back, Larry? Why can't they go, well, this is basically good enough?
I wish I could figure out the answer to that, because they have this fear, and I have deep intimate conversations with people, and they have with lawmakers, the people, and they have this fear that they're going to be vilified, and they think that there's this massive amount of people that's going to deluge them with anti-incumbent, that it's just going to be a career breaker. And I can't say that I disagree with them. They are going to, their opponents are going to hit them with their soft on sex offenders. But I just don't think the average person who's out there thinking about it, the average citizen knows there's a such thing as a registry. The average citizen knows that as far as what they think they know, that's why I don't have that sticker that says don't believe everything you think. What they think they know is that it's got a really, you got to be a really creepy individual to be on there. But the average person doesn't get immersed in the nuances of the registry. And if you just tell the average voter, the courts won't let us do this, we can't, most intelligent voters will understand that. We do have a constitution that constrains us in terms of what we can do, and we just can't do all these things you'd like us to do. You know, we can't do that in a society that has a constitution that we're bound to follow. You do believe in the constitution, don't you? Well, I'm saying that's what I would say that was what I would say to the voters. I mean, you do support the U.S. Constitution, right?
Yeah,
we can't just dump on these people anything that we want to after they've paid their debt to society. But Judge Harrell, who was part of the Doe decision that declared Maryland be punitive, stated that dissemination of non-public consent information about registrants presented the risk of being stigmatized, and noted that registrants were required to inform the state of every change of location. And I've harped on this. Your conviction is public, but all the stuff that you're required to provide for the public is not a part of your conviction. If they just simply said, Andy, you're convicted, this is public, we've put you on a list, congratulations, you're on a bad list of people going about life, that's not unconstitutional. But when they say, Andy, tell us what you drive, tell us where you work, tell us who you're living with, tell us where you're planning to travel to if you're going to be gone more than 3 days, tell us where you're going to school at, tell us all this stuff so we can put it online, that isn't a part of the conviction. That is not public information. And that's where the line is drawn in terms of how far they can disseminate information that was not a part of the conviction. The conviction itself is public.
Let me throw this at you, and I don't mean to exclude you, Brenda, not at all. I remember when the ACA was passed that there was a lot of talk about, we don't know what's in it. And I recall it being like one of the mantras of it was, we will, if it doesn't work, we will amend it, we will fix it, and we will continue to evolve it to where it gets closer to working. Why can't this, you know, like we constantly amend this thing, but we couldn't amend that. So I'm trying to bring up like a split brain thing here where that was the bad thing and we can't amend it, but this thing is just constantly, constantly, constantly getting changed and the screws tighten deeper and deeper.
Well, what's the question? Could we amend it? Yes. What's the question?
Sure. Well, I mean, we weren't willing to even entertain the thought of amending the ACA, where obviously this thing gets amended constantly. I know that this is state law versus federal law, but that there's a the idea of amending it obviously exists, but we couldn't amend that thing. And I'm not trying to pick on that the ACA is the best thing ever. I'm just trying to bring up that as being like a super duper big example of a thing that we weren't willing to amend, and it's just constantly being squashed. But the registry stuff just constantly keeps getting amended and the screws tightened. Well, and I know I haven't really asked you a question, but I'm still just like, why do we have the split brain personality that some things we can change, but some things we cannot?
Well, there's generally broad support for the registry. There was very little bipartisan support for the Affordable Care Act. That was largely a Democratic, or as they call it, a Democrat proposal. And the registry enjoys almost universal support. If you dare express any opposition to the registry, you do so at your own peril politically. The Affordable Care Act was easy to vilify because it was a government takeover of 1/5 or 1/6. I forget what they said. It was like 1/5 or 1/6 of the economy, a government takeover of healthcare, and it was going to cause death panels and rationing of care and all these horrible things that were there that were untrue. But that was the scare tactics that were used.
Speaking of death panels, we are maybe approaching those kind of ideals coming down the pike where they have to triage and pick this person over that person.
Well, we are definitely, if the doctors, Fauci and the I forget what her name is, Dr. Burke, was it Burke, Brenda? But anyway, if they're accurate and if the projections are accurate, we're going to soon be at the point where there's not going to be enough care and capacity for the people who need the care. So yes, we are going to have some decisions made.
Larry, we're about ready to close it down. If you are, we have a voicemail message that I just want to throw out there. And it's not terribly long, and I had to kind of piece it together to make it work. It's mostly just comments from one of our listeners. We ready to hit that?
Let's do it.
Hey, Registry Matters. Brian from New York. How are you? Just wanted to stop and say hello. Make sure everyone's okay. Also wanted to let you know how the registry was used against me. I answered the call. I was assigned frontline work, taking temperatures of people. So nurses and other healthcare professionals can be free to treat other people who might have symptoms of COVID. I did this without a mask or without a glove or without gloves. I put myself in harm's way to help other people and to make sure that nobody would come into a facility that would be exposed to anyone. So just wanted to let you know that I was doing volunteer work at certain locations, and someone noticed me from the law enforcement area, gave a call to my supervisor, and they told me I was discharged due to the fact that I was on the registry. Nothing else about criminal background, just that I was on the registry. The guy that gave me the chance, I already let him know that I had to check his background and everything. He did give me the chance. But I was at the governor's whim to do the work that I was doing. So I had to be careful, and I was professional, and I was very well groomed, and I did everything I was supposed to do correct. It was never an issue. And FYP.
He got fired from doing medical work, helping people with the COVID crisis. Because he's on the registry.
I was having trouble following it, but I thought that's what I was getting from it at the end.
So I just wanted to throw that out there as a person that, by his testimony there, that he was trying to help out the medical community and volunteering to help with the temperature checks and stuff to screen patients walking in the door. And somehow he was noticed, which I'm not really sure how, but he was noticed and they terminated him because of it.
Well, you know that there's a spew of radiation that comes out of any PFR.
That's right. The hovercrafts were following, and that's how they knew.
That's how they knew. And I don't mean to make a joke of it, but if you're in a smaller community, you can be noticed if you're in a large community if you haven't run across your registry officer. But the smaller the place is, the more likely you're going to be noticed, because if you're in a town of 3,000, it's just hard to vanish if you're in a city of 750,000, so or 8 million or whatever New York City is.
Larry, I think we can wrap this whole thing up, and I'm going to flip the script on you about closing out the podcast tonight just a little bit. Like, if you want to find all the ways to contact us, you can certainly go to the show notes. All the things are there. However, because of the times, I don't want to like push the whole Patreon thing. But please, please, pretty please, if you can go to any of the places where you listen to podcasts, iTunes or Google Podcasts, any of those platforms that you get your podcast from, please go give us a rating, preferably a 5-star one, and give us a comment. It would help us out immensely in reaching more people. And that's certainly what we're trying to do most of all, is to reach more of our people. And I hope everybody stays safe and wash your hands, of course. And someone on another podcast said, wash your damn hands. So wash your hands. And that's all I got, Larry. And I hope you stay safe. And I will talk to you so very, very, very soon.
Thanks, Andy.
Have a great night. Bye-bye.
Good night.